You're listening to the Save the Marriage Podcast. Your marriage can be saved and strengthened if you have the right information. Join Dr. Lee Baucom as he explores ways for you to improve your relationship and your life, starting right now.
Hey, this is Lee Baucom. Welcome to the Save the Marriage Podcast. The Save the Marriage Podcast is not just about saving your marriage, but how to improve your marriage and how to improve your life. And today we're going to talk about one area that's going to impact lots of your life. And I'm going to give you a little background on why that is. And what I want you to think back on is times when you have tried to maybe build some trust with somebody. Either you're trying to trust them or get them to trust you. This is a very common situation when you're trying to save your marriage. Usually there are a number of incidences in the past that are kind of raw and held out there. And so in the past weeks, you'll notice a couple of things we've talked about. One is I talked about forgiveness. Forgiveness is a crucial issue in working to save your marriage. It's particularly true that you have control over how you forgive and the choice to forgive. And so we covered that several weeks back, and then we talked about apologies last week. I talked about how to make an apology and the steps to apologies and those four basic rules of an apology. So an apology is what you do when you're taking responsibility for some action that you did. So what happens after that? Sometimes people say, you know what, I don't know what to do about the trust. I've had person after person in my office, and you know, they've worked through to this point where they're trying to step forward, and one person says, I just don't know if I can trust them anymore. Or one person says, I don't know how to get that trust back. It works both ways, and the same core pieces are true either way. And so today we're going to talk about something very interesting. We're going to talk about why it might be difficult for you to trust, but also why it might be difficult for your spouse or your significant other to trust you. What happens in that process? Now, one of the things that I've said over and over is that trust cannot truly be earned. It cannot be earned because it is a gift. And I want to tell you why I believe that and why that is such a dominant factor in working to get that trust back. Notice that trust can be destroyed. You can take somebody's trust that they've given you and do something wrong and destroy it, or they can do the same to you. So trust can be destroyed by your actions, but it cannot be regained until someone is willing to give it. It's a gift to be given. And that's why I say that trust cannot be earned. It is a gift. The problem is that people tend to side on one or the other. They either make trust way too expensive, meaning that, you know, you can work and work and work and do everything right for year after year after year and still not regain the trust. And others make it way too cheap. You do something wrong and they instantly move forward and start trusting you again. Neither one of those are appropriate ways of dealing with trust. It's just ways that we've done it, which raises the question of why we are that way. Why do some people trust so readily and others refuse to trust? Why do some people get caught up in whether to trust or not and others readily jump into that process of trusting again, even in spite of evidence? I've had some people tell me that, you know, they don't know what to do because over and over they've extended trust. A spouse has either had financial infidelity or physical infidelity or emotional infidelity or using porn or all those kind of things that kind of rupture the trust of a relationship. And then they try to get it back. And sometimes a spouse will repeatedly go back to that, repeatedly step back into trusting again, only to be burned again. And others, one time and you're out. So that raises the question of what that's about. So let's reflect a bit on one of my core beliefs about marriage, that marriage is nurtured in the connection between two people. In fact, I draw that theory from lots of places, but one is what is termed attachment theory in social psychology, how we attach. And this goes back to how we attach in childhood. Particularly how our ways of attaching, our ways of trusting are built in the relationship with our caregivers. One of the haunting moments I remember from psychology when I was studying was in every textbook, they had this experiment, which was the monkey baby, monkey mama experiment. This has direct relevance to humans because primates and humans share a way of connecting. We have a common need for connection that is particularly strong for us, and that infants need a particularly strong amount of connection. You know, if you think about in other animals, for instance, if you look at snakes, you know, the mama snake just creates the snakes and may protect the snakes, but there's not going to be a whole lot of attachment. And fish are the same way. You know, they may protect the eggs instinctively, but once the fish are born, they are often eaten by the parents or immediately eaten by something else because there's just not a lot of attachment there. It's different with humans. Humans have a great need for attachment that lasts a long time. That's why childhood lasts 18 years or sometimes well into the 20s and 30s for some people, because we're needing the attachment in our family that nurtures that. So attachment theory says that your basic trust of the world is the first piece of that attachment. It happens at a very young age. In fact, 0 to about 6 months in Eric Erickson's study. Eric Erickson was the researcher who talked about different stages of development. And the first one he called trust versus mistrust. Can I trust the world or do I mistrust the world? And remember, the world for a 3-month-old or a 6-month-old are the parents. Do I get fed when I'm hungry? Do I get held when I need that attachment? Do my diapers get changed when I've wet them or soiled them? Are my basic needs covered? And if when I'm upset, I'm nurtured, if when I'm hungry, I'm fed, if when I am cold or wet or, you know, messy diapers, if those are basic needs are taken care of, I begin to assume that the world is a safe place, that I can trust the world to be safe. And I carry that through my life. Someone who doesn't get that might learn that the world is not such a trustworthy place, that you learn to mistrust those around you, that they're not going to take care of you. And that has a lifelong impact. According to Erickson, until you finished one stage, you were hampered in other stages along the way. And so the basic moment of that trust mistrust, if it's missed, is very difficult to continue through. And so attachment theory says that we have several different childhood attachment styles based in how we're parented. And we take those childhood attachment styles and take them into adulthood, where they begin to either help our relationships or cripple our relationships. So I want you to kind of listen with two ears. One ear in the attachment style is what you think of your family, what you brought out of your family, how you learned to attach in your family, and then think about how your spouse was in their family, in his or her family, in your spouse's or significant other's family. What was the attachment like? And begin to think through, this is kind of a diagnostic, what kind of attachment did I experience and did my spouses experience? Because once you begin to find those different styles, you can begin to understand why trust might be an issue, why fear might be an issue, why forgiveness might be an issue, why all these difficulties might be issues. Now, be very careful, because it's unfair if you only diagnose your spouse or significant other and miss the fact that you too have a style that you bring into adulthood. Okay, so let's talk about the childhood attachment styles first. The first one is called the secure attachment style. In secure attachment, we have parenting. Our needs are met and our boundaries are secure. The parents are not overly intrusive, but they're caring and they take care of our needs when they come. And when that happens, we learn to securely attach to significant people in our lives. We have a secure attachment. We tend to have a positive approach to that in childhood. You know, we trust that we can attach to significant adults in our life. So the first one is secure, and that's a good place. Unfortunately, many of us had other styles of parenting that might have left a little limping place or a lot of limping in our attachment. For instance, the next attachment style is called avoidant. Now, in an avoidant attachment style. It comes because the parents did not do the caring necessary, did not care for a child when necessary, didn't seem to notice the needs, and they left the child struggling for attachment. Now let's go back to that monkey mama, monkey baby experiment. Because what they did is they took the baby from the mama and they let the baby choose between two different wire mesh mamas. The first one was wrapped in warm blankets, terry cloth blankets, and was shaped like the mama monkey, but it was warm and it had these warm, nurturing cloths around it. The second one was wireframe, wire cold wire mesh, steel mesh, but it held a bottle. It held food for the baby. And so they let the child choose which would the baby monkey choose. The baby monkey would always choose the terry cloth, nurturing, warm mama over the food to the point of starvation. So that tells us that we have this deep need for attachment, and even when some needs aren't met, we keep trying to get that attachment. We keep trying to get the nurture we need. And so in an avoidant pattern, there is no care from the parents, or at least not enough care. And remember, this is in degrees. It's not absolute. So it's not you got all your needs met or none of your needs met. It's how much your needs were not met. And so in an avoidant pattern, the parents did not do the caring necessary to build that attachment. But the child still needs that attachment and is left struggling to find that attachment with them. So that's the avoidant style. Can't get my needs met, but I'm still going to figure out how to get that attachment. Then there's the ambivalent, anxious style of attachment. This is with unpredictable parents. Parents would sometimes nurture appropriately and then would be insensitive or intrusive to the child, either not notice the needs or so take over that the child is overwhelmed with the parents. So sometimes they got appropriate, other times they were overwhelmed or underwhelmed with the attachment. When this happens, the child becomes suspicious and distrustful, and yet at the same time, clingy and desperate for attachment. So on the one hand, they are thinking or feeling that they're not going to get those needs met, and yet at the other time, they become very clingy trying to get that need met because they've had this off and on ambivalence with the parent. Then there's the disorganized attachment style for children. And in the disorganized attachment style, it comes from abusive parents. Now, the abuse can be emotional, it can be physical, it can be sexual, but when it's abusive, the child becomes fearful. But the child still needs attachment. And if you both need the attachment and fear being harmed, you have to detach from yourself. So a child from this family basically detaches from the self, just kind of zones out from what's going on in the abuse, to try to attach to the abuser. So on the one hand, they know their needs are not going to be met, and yet on the other hand, they have to push that away and not notice it for the attachment they can get. Notice how much that splits a child from themselves. They have to not notice themselves, not notice their feelings, set their feelings aside, push them down, and avoid those feelings in order to find some level of attachment. That's how deep our need for attachment goes, that you even have to make friends with and connection with an abuser in order to get one need met while you're putting yourself at risk. Okay, so those are the childhood attachment styles. Secure, avoidant, which comes from when parents don't do much caring, ambivalent, anxious, when it comes from unpredictable parents that sometimes will care and other times don't, or disorganized, which comes from abusive parents. What happens into adulthood? Well, if you come from a secure childhood style, then you're able to attach appropriately. You're able to have a strong and positive sense of the self and of relationships. Now, that doesn't mean you're always upbeat and you feel like everything's always going to be okay. But overall, generally, you trust yourself and you trust others and you can create an attachment. It's much easier for somebody from a secure attachment to build trust and rebuild trust in appropriate ways, to not be taken advantage of, and yet be willing to trust again when appropriate measures have been taken to fix situations. Okay, so a secure is that middle point when the cost of trust is balanced between too expensive and too cheap. You find that true place of being able to say, I can trust other people, but I can't always trust other people. There's a medium point. Okay, the next style is dismissive. A dismissive adult attachment style comes from the avoidant childhood style. Remember, avoidant comes when the parents didn't do the caring, didn't give enough caring for the child. And so when that happens, they tend to be loners that think that relationships are unimportant. You know, if you haven't found the value of a relationship with a parent, then you don't carry that into adulthood. So they suppress feelings and avoid conflict in relationships. Now, I want to say one clarification. This is not about being introvert or an extrovert. I say that because I'm an introvert, and I don't think that it's from a dismissive attachment style. An introvert is someone who draws energy from inward, not with lack of relationship, but an extrovert is someone who draws it from a crowd. My brother is an extrovert. I'm an introvert. My brother, to recharge, wants to be around other people and enjoys being in social situations. I, when I get tired, need to seek solace and quiet and maybe one or two other people. It's not that I think that relationships are unimportant. It's just that when I am tapped out, I have to find a way of recharging away from that. So don't confuse the fact that someone in adulthood may be fine by themselves or may only have a few friends with being a true loner that thinks that relationships are unimportant. This is when you just go, you know what, it's just not, this relationship I don't need. It's not important to me. So they suppress their feelings and avoid conflict in relationships. At that point, somebody who comes from a dismissive attachment style is going to be very hard to get them to trust again. They'll stay away from that because they've been burned once. So they become dismissive of needing that other person and dismissive of trusting again. Okay, then there's the preoccupied adult attachment style. That comes from the ambivalent, anxious childhood. An ambivalent, anxious childhood had unpredictable parents that sometimes nurtured appropriately, but other times were insensitive and or intrusive. And so as that happens, adults become self-critical and insecure. Adults from this style seek approval, but then reject it when it's given. You know, they might say, hey, look at what I did. And you say, oh, that's a great job. Oh, no, it wasn't anything. It's no big deal. That can be a symptom of the preoccupied spot. They have a deep-seated fear of rejection that leaves them worried and untrusting. So you violate somebody's trust from a preoccupied place, and they're going to be very cautious to give it again because they're already worried that it's going to happen all over again. Already a bit untrusting of the world taking care of their needs. And so it's from a very cautious position about whether to trust again or not. The last one is the fearful avoidant, which comes from the disorganized childhood. Remember, disorganized had abusive parents, whether it's emotional, physical, psychological, sexual, the abuse creates a distancing. And so from that disorganized childhood, they have a fearful avoidance style. So the adult stays detached from the self, but attaches to other people. They're unaware of how they're even feeling. You know, it's not that they don't have feelings, they're just not connected with those feelings. So they don't know what that feeling in their gut is when it's anger or frustration or whatever. They have to shut off those feelings and pretend they do not exist in order to continue staying in connection. But the problem is childhood feelings reemerge, and sometimes even memories may reemerge later on. And the reason for that is because things stir them in adulthood, particularly when we have kids about the same age as when there might have been abuse. When an adult who was abused as a child has a child that hits their same stage when they were abused, it often triggers the feelings. It often triggers the memories because they're watching it again and are fearful for that child. So in adulthood, those feelings reemerge, and sometimes the feelings reemerge and they place them on the other person. They begin to treat the other person like they would have treated the parent. they distance or move away or try to control and do lots of things to a safe adult or hopefully safe adult that they needed to have done with a parent or couldn't do with a parent or even had to do with a parent. They begin to create a re-experience that abusive relationship with the new person. Okay, what's really happening is they're no longer living in the moment. They're reliving old traumas in the current relationship. They're making it as if what happened in childhood is now happening and again in adulthood. And so when you break the trust, they become detached from their true self. And so they might quickly trust again because it's a way of one, making sure that that person stays with them, and two, of needing that connection. And instead of paying attention to those feelings, they make it a cheap thing. Trust is very, very cheap, sometimes very expensive just because they mistrust everybody around them. But sometimes this is where you see them trusting over and over and over and over again, in spite of the evidence that that person is not trustworthy. Okay, so the secure a place of attachment is when attachment is appropriate. They have a strong sense of self and a positive sense of relationships. The dismissive is when they tend to be loners, feel like relationships are unimportant, and they suppress feelings and avoid conflict in relationships. And so sometimes they will avoid stepping back into a difficult situation, working through the issues, and trusting again. The preoccupied adult attachment style comes from that ambivalent, anxious childhood. They become self-critical and insecure. They seek approval, but then they don't accept it. They reject it. They have a deep-seated fear of rejection that leaves them both worried and untrusting. So they want to find some way of attaching. They just don't feel like they can. And so you find this very worrisome place into the childhood or into adulthood where they can find no ways of trusting. And then there's the fearful avoidant, which comes from that abusive childhood. And at that point, they're detached from themselves. And so they just trust again and again and again, hoping that they can get the attachment that they need. Okay, so what do you do? The first thing is you assess your style. What are you bringing in from childhood? What are you bringing into your adulthood attachment style? You assess your style first. It's always important to start with what you're dragging in. Assess that and address those issues first. This is a great time of using an individual therapist and finding somebody who has an understanding of attachment styles and has experience helping you work through those places that are not quite finished. You'll notice that there are probably very few people who have an entirely secure approach to attachments. We all have lingering scars from childhood, places we didn't quite get things met, needs met. And so we might all have little pieces of another style. And so to address your issues first is very important. The second step is to lovingly assess your spouse's style and understand with empathy. This sometimes helps explain why it's so hard to regain trust when it's been broken. If you understand what style they're bringing from childhood, you can begin to say, wow, that's why it's so difficult for them to trust. It's not entirely about me. They have their own issues of trust. And so that can give you a place of empathy, of saying, okay, I understand what's going on with them. Now, you lovingly assess your spouse's style because it's so easy at this point to begin to express blame. Oh, I know why you can't trust me. Or, oh, I know why we're stuck here. It's because of your childhood. And whenever you launch into that, you will have lost your spouse because you're going to be pointing fingers at the other person, not at what's happened between the two of you. It's always going to feel like one more level of blame. So approach this lovingly, understanding that we all drag those pieces into adulthood, but it can help you understand when you use empathy of why it can be difficult to recreate that trust once it's broken. Okay, so there are some tasks though, specifically to rebuild the trust. First task you have in rebuilding trust is to be trustworthy. That may be obvious, but it's important for me to say, to be trustworthy. Treat trust as a gift that you should treasure as much as possible. Recognize that when trust is there, you should treasure that. Whatever level of trust is still there, treasure it. Protect it. Don't let anything get in the way. Understand the challenge there is when you have to reestablish trust. It's so much easier to be trustworthy than to try to regain trust once it's lost. It's so much easier on the front side. So the first thing is to always be trustworthy. Be worthy of the trust that the other person gives you. Treat it as a gift to be treasured, to be protected, to be honored. That's step one. Even if you've broken the trust, go back to that. Even if you've broken that, become that person who is trustworthy. And then be that person trustworthy from now on. The second one is be transparent. If you have transgressed, you have to be fully transparent. If you have committed any kind of infidelity, whether it's financial infidelity or emotional or physical or any other type of infidelity, or if you have done something that ruptures trust, it is important to be 100% fully transparent. Now, what that means is that if somebody says, if your spouse says, hey, let me see your phone, let me see your email, let me see your Facebook account, let me see your messaging, let me see your Snapchat, let me see your Twitter account, I mean, whatever it is they need to see, if you have broken the trust, you have to be that transparent in order to hope to rebuild it. Because they have to know that they can trust you. Remember, you're trying to be trustworthy. So be transparent in that. Let them see what they need to see to reassure themselves. Now, if you have not transgressed, not every area of your life has to require full transparency. It's not okay if you've not done nothing wrong to always be having to turn over passwords and turn over your phone and turn over your emails and turn over your messaging. If you have not done nothing wrong and you can search your heart and say, I have done nothing wrong, then you don't have to be fully transparent. But be willing to have a conversation about what is necessary in order to get to a better trusting place. Sometimes the other person has come from a place of attachment in childhood where you have to overplay your willingness for transparency in order to reassure. Just recognize that that's not fully necessary. That's something you can negotiate about and talk about, but only if you have not transgressed. If you have done something that has ruptured the trust, then you need to be 100% fully transparent if you want to rebuild the trust. If you say, well, I don't want to be 100% transparent, I understand that. But there is a price to be paid for when we've done that, and that's the price. When we rupture trust, the price if we want to rebuild trust is to be 100% transparent. Number three, accept that this is a long-term goal. A long-term project. It can take a long time to restore trust. Remember, you're pulling back from stuff that might have happened in childhood that now you've recreated. It's reemerged, and so you have to be willing to stick it out. It's much easier to maintain trust than to restore trust. So once it's been ruptured, just recognize it could be a long-term project. If you're expecting that in just a few days you should be trusted again when you've done something, don't think that. Think instead that this is long-term. It's going to take a while. It's going to be something that you're going to continue to work on and that you're going to be trustworthy in that process. Trustworthy, transparent, and it's a long-term project. And then the fourth one is understand that some people will not trust again, no matter what you do. Some people will bring scars from childhood into their relationship and will not be able to restore the trust. That may include you. And if you feel like you're at that place that you cannot give trust again, you might want to work through that as your issue, not just an issue in the relationship. Trust is something that we have to respect from the other person, but we have to be willing to risk if it's us. If we're offering that trust, we have to be willing to risk it. So understand that no matter what you do, sometimes somebody else is not going to trust you. But most will, if you're willing to stick to it, if you're willing to be trustworthy, if you're willing to be transparent, if you're willing to see that this is step by step, accepting it's a long-term project, most will learn to trust you again. Okay, so that's kind of the rules of rebuilding trust. Hopefully, you'll think through what is your style of attachment, what is your spouse's style of attachment, where did that come from? Recognize that those can be healed, and then take the steps to rebuild the trust. Be trustworthy, be transparent. Accept this is a long-term project. Understand that some people may not be able to trust again. They've been too injured to trust again, and that might include you. And if it includes you, that's time to go get somebody to help you work through those issues so that you can get beyond the limitations from childhood. Okay, so now's the time for me to ask for a little help from you. Let me know what you thought about this. Leave a comment if you're on the blog. Leave a comment below. If you're listening on the website, savethemarriage.com/STM blog, the Save the Marriage blog, then you can leave a comment there. If you're not on the blog, if you're listening to this from, like a lot of people, from iTunes and Stitcher and some of the other podcast aggregators, then you might want to go and leave a comment. And you can do that simply by going to savethemarriageblog.com. That's savethemarriageblog.com. That'll take you right to the blog. You can find this podcast. Just go to the bottom, go to the comments area. Let me know what you think. Also, I would love to hear if you have some ideas for other podcasts. You can do that one of two ways. One is to just email me. It's podcast@savethemarriage.com. That's podcast@savethemarriage.com. Now, I need to warn you, that's a way of letting me know some ideas of topics you'd like to have covered. That's not a way of getting help for your marriage. There are other avenues we have for that. That's not it. I'm just looking for what would you like to have covered. What are the topics that hang out that for you? If you want to leave me a voicemail, you can go to the pod phone, which is at the number 4 and then help, H-E-L-P, and then the number is 44132. That's 4HELP, 44132, or 443-574-4132. That's 443-574-4132. Also, a lot of times people ask me how they can find my Kindle book. That's got some stuff, how to save your marriage in 3 simple steps. And you can find that very easily. Just type in savethemarriage.com/Kindle. That's savethemarriage.com/Kindle. That'll take you right to the Amazon page, and you can get that on any device that you might have. And if you've got an electronic device, Amazon has figured out how you can read that book. So grab that. The last thing is you can help me out a lot. If you're listening to iTunes, please leave a review. Please leave a recommendation for people. You can give me whatever stars you think are appropriate and leave a comment about what you like or don't like about this podcast. If you don't like a lot, let me know. But if you like something, please let others know so that they can find the help they need and can know what's in this process. The other thing is if you're on Twitter, you can help me spread the word. Just type into your browser, savethemarriage.com/love. That's savethemarriage.com/love. That will pre-populate a tweet for you. You can just hit send, or you can modify it if you want to, but it'll let people know how to find this podcast and that you like it. That would be great for me as we continue to try to spread the word and help other people save their marriage. If you found help, please help others find help by just either leaving a review, a rating, a comment, or sending out a tweet. That would be great. Know that we're here to help you save your marriage. This is Lee Balcom wishing you the best. Until next time, take care.
You've been listening to Save the Marriage Podcast. For more information and help, please visit us at savethemarriage.com.